The Years of Lyndon Johnson, The Path to Power, by Robert A. Caro, Part 2. Continued on Cassette Number 4, Side 1. Seeing her shyness, her almost visible terror at having attention called to herself, acquaintances were soon making a remark that would be repeated for decades by acquaintances of the Johnsons. I don't know how she stands it. The interest in culture, the promises to take her to museums and libraries, and all of those most interesting places when you are mine, was somewhat less apparent once she was, in fact, his. Exploring Washington thrilled her. I remember a song, Walking in a Winter Wonderland, she says. I'd just walk and explore because it was all so fresh and new. But because Lyndon worked all day, every day, and she was too shy to make friends, she did the exploring alone. In the evenings, he might not be in the office, but that did not mean he would be in a place that did not interest him. He would not, except on the rarest of occasions, take Lady Bird even to a movie. As for plays, when in desperation she purchased two tickets to the Theatre Guild's four-play season at the National Theatre, her husband would take her to the door. He would not go inside. Russell Brown says, I was always prepared to see her home, but she would never let me do so. She always went home by herself. But I went to the Theatre Guild that season with her. I remember he used to bring her and say, Now I'll see you later. They were fairly expensive tickets and so on, but he wouldn't go to the theater. Her hopes of sitting quietly, sharing the joy of a good book with her husband, were not frequently fulfilled. She had, in fact, no more success than L.E. Jones had had in persuading him to look for more than a minute or two at any printed matter less timely than a news magazine or the Congressional Record. She then tried to underline paragraphs in books she thought he should read, but even if the subject was politics or government, his lack of interest was so marked that she soon was playing a scene that would have been familiar to residents of Johnson City, who had watched Lyndon Johnson's mother following him to the front gate in the morning, reading his lessons to him because he would not read them himself. If he would not read an underlined passage, Lady Bird would try to read it to him, sometimes following him about the apartment to do so. She found it easier to fulfill other functions that Johnson regarded as wifely, however much they may have conflicted with her own training or expectations of married life. Here are her own words on the subject. He early announced, I'd like to have coffee in bed. And I thought, what? Me? But I soon realized that it's less trouble serving someone that way than by setting the table and all. Did she also realize that it was less trouble to bring him his newspaper in bed so that he could read it as he sipped his coffee? To lay out his clothes, and so that he wouldn't be bothered with the chore of placing things in pockets, to herself put his pen, after filling it, in the proper pocket, his cigarette lighter, after checking the level of its fluid, in the proper pocket, his handkerchief and money in the proper pocket, to shine his shoes. He insisted that she do these chores, and she did them. One chore was particularly difficult for her. Hospitality is, of course, a potent political weapon, and Johnson was, of course, planning to employ it. Hardly had they moved into their little apartment when he informed Bird that a congressman, Maury Maverick, and his wife would be coming for dinner. Not only her shyness about her upbringing in a house full of Negro servants made entertaining difficult for the young wife. Until the day she moved to Kalorama Road, she recalls, I had never swept a floor, and I certainly had never cooked. Mrs. Maverick says that when she entered the Johnsons' apartment, in which a table had been set in the living room, and met Lady Bird, she felt as if a little girl had invited me, and not just because of the obvious nervousness of her small, slim hostess. One of the first things I saw was a Fanny Farmer cookbook open on the table, Mrs. Maverick says. Staring at me was a recipe for boiled rice. The menu included baked ham, lemon pie, and, of course, the rice. The ham and pie were very good, but I'll never forget that rice. It tasted like library paste. To this day, I connect boiled rice and library paste. But Mrs. Maverick was also struck by the bride, by her sweetness and graciousness as a hostess. By the way, covering her nervousness with a smile that never wavered, she made both the congressman and his wife, so much older than the Johnsons, feel at home in the little apartment. Others were struck by the same qualities. Congressmen like Marvin Jones and Ewing Thomason, who condescended to accept a staffer's dinner invitation because the staffer's father was Sam Johnson. Young reporters. Get the furniture insured for Friday night, Johnson told Bird one day. I'm having a bunch of newspapermen out there. We'll have a wild evening. older congressional secretaries like Kate George and younger contemporaries of her husband's. All felt, as she said goodnight to them at the door with, "You all come back real soon, here now," that she really wanted them to. And this graciousness, Lady Bird Johnson's remarkable ability to make anyone feel at home, was, within just a few months of their marriage, to give her husband's career the biggest boost it had yet received. For one of the guests visiting the Johnsons' little apartment, visiting it more and more frequently, coming regularly, after a while, every Sunday for breakfast, and staying longer and longer each Sunday, sitting always in a straight, hard chair, but week by week bending forward more, hands on his knees to tell stories of Texas, and more relaxed, chatting with Lyndon Johnson hour after hour, was a man who seldom visited anyone, who had never visited anyone regularly, a man as shy in his own way as Lady Bird was in hers, a small, stocky man with a bald head and a face like a rock, Sam Rayburn. Chapter 18. Rayburn. Rayburn. Rayburn, who hated the railroads, whose freight charges fleeced the farmer, and the banks, whose interest charges fleeced the farmer, and the utility companies, which refused to extend their power lines into the countryside, and thus condemned the farmer to darkness. Rayburn, who hated the trusts and the interests. Rayburn, who hated the rich and all their devices. Rayburn, who hated the Republican Party, which he regarded as one of those devices. Hated it for currency policies that, he said, make the rich richer and the poor poorer. Hated it for the tariff, the robber tariff, the most indefensible system that the world has ever known, he called it, because the Republican Party fooled the farmer into supporting the tariff, he said. The rich fatten their already swollen purses with more ill-gotten gains wrung from the horny hands of the toiling masses. And hated it for Reconstruction, too. The son of a Confederate cavalryman who never stopped hating the Yankees, Rayburn, a friend once said, will not in his long lifetime forget Appomattox. For years after he came to Congress, the walls of his office bore many pictures, but all were of one man, Robert E. Lee. In 1928, when his district was turning to the Republican Hoover over Al Smith, and he was advised to turn with it or risk losing his own congressional seat, he growled, "As long as I honor the memory of the Confederate dead and revere the gallant devotion of my Confederate father to the Southland, I will never vote for electors of a party which sent the carpetbagger and the scalawag to the prostrate South with saber and sword." Rayburn, who hated the railroads and the banks and the Republicans because he never forgot who he was or where he came from. Forgetting would have been difficult. He was born on January 6, 1882, on a 40-acre farm in Tennessee, whose worn-out soil could not support so many children. He was the 8th of 11. And in 1887, the Rayburns moved to a 40-acre farm in Texas, in Fannin County, northeast of Dallas. The 1,000-mile train trip to Texas provided him with one of his most enduring memories. From the train windows, he was to recall, he saw the people on their trek west, all their earthly belongings heaped on covered wagons, men in plainsmen's outfits with wide-brimmed hats and guns on their shoulders, leading the oxen. The first year in Texas almost finished the Rayburns. Floods covered the fields, and boll weevils feasted on the cotton that survived. And out of the 40 acres, only 2.5 bales. Although Fannin County soil was deep, rich loam, and the rainfall plenty, 40 acres was inadequate for a large family when the interest on the mortgage was 10% and cotton was selling for 9 cents a pound. The Rayburns managed to hold the farm year after year only because the whole family, even 5-year-old Sam, worked in the fields. Except for 4 months each year in a one-room, one-teacher schoolhouse, Sam Rayburn spent his boyhood in the cotton rows. In the spring, he plowed while he was still so small that his weight couldn't keep the plow point in the ground, and he had to strain to hold it down as the mules yanked it forward. In the summer, under the searing Texas sun, he worked with a hoe, chopping at the plants to thin them out, going to bed at night with an aching back, knowing that at daybreak he would be out with the hoe again. And in September he would be in the rows on his knees, crawling down the rows, dragging behind him a long sack, while he picked the cotton, on the rows day after day, knees raw and bleeding from the crawling, hands raw and bleeding from the picking, back aching even worse than from the chopping. "I plowed and hoed from sun till sun," Sam Rayburn was to recall. as some of our city friends who talk about the beauty and romance of farm life would go out and bend their backs over a cotton row for 10 or 12 hours per day and grip the plow handles that long, they would see how fast this romance they have read in the novels would leave, and how surely it would come down to a humdrum life of work and toil. Work and toil, and little to show for it, thanks to the government's tariff and currency policies. The injustice that farmers felt was embodied in these policies, and that made Northeast Texas a stronghold of the People's Party, was exemplified by the inclusion of steer hides on the free, unprotected by tariff, list, which meant that farmers received little for their steer hides, and the inclusion of the shoes manufactured from steer hides on the protected list, which forced farmers to pay high prices for shoes. Cotton prices were kept low, too. When, after a year's work in the fields by the entire family, its cotton went to the gin, the Rayburns might have left, after paying the furnishing merchant and the mortgage holder and the railroad's cruelly high freighting charges, in a good year, as much as $25 to show for the year's labor. And it wasn't the work and toil, or the poverty, from which he suffered most. Except when telling stories about the war, the most prominent object in the living room was a framed picture of General Lee. His father, the bearded Confederate veteran, was a gentle but very silent man. And his mother, Hard Boss, the family called her because of her rigidity, who loved and was devoted to her children, was careful to conceal her affection. To Sam's parents, a biographer says, any show of sentiment toward young children was a sign of weakness. All through his boyhood, Sam's life was the cotton fields, the fields and little else. If Sunday chores were light, they were supposed to be replaced not by play, but by piety. Many a time when I was a child and lived way out in the country, Sam Rayburn later recalled, I'd sit on the fence and wish to God that somebody would ride by on a horse or drive by in a buggy, just anybody to relieve my loneliness. Terrible as were the toil and the poverty, the loneliness was worse. Poverty, he was to say, only tries men's souls. It is loneliness that breaks the heart. Loneliness consumes people. In the bleakness and boredom of Sam Rayburn's childhood, there stood out a single vivid day. Fannin County's congressman was Joseph Weldon Bailey, who, as minority leader of the House of Representatives, dominated the Democratic minority like an overseer and conducted himself like a conqueror, and was expected, if the Democrats won control of Congress, to become Speaker. Bailey was one of the greatest of the great populist orators. When he spoke in the House, it was said, his tones lingered in the chamber like the echo of chimes in a cathedral. In 1894, when Sam Rayburn was 12, Bailey spoke in Bonham, the county seat. And Sam Rayburn heard him. He was to remember all his life, every detail of that day, how it was raining so heavily that his mule took hours to cover the 11 miles to town, how he felt when he arrived at the covered tent tabernacle of the Bonham Evangelical Church, where Bailey was speaking. I didn't go into that tabernacle. I'd never been to Bonham since we bought the farm, and I was scared of all the rich town folks in their store-bought clothes. But I found a flap in the canvas, and I stuck there like glue while old Joe Bailey made his speech. And most vividly of all, he remembered Joe Bailey. He went on for 2 solid hours, and I scarcely drew a breath the whole time. I can still feel the water dripping down my neck. I slipped around to the entrance again when he was through, saw him come out, and ran after him 5 or 6 blocks until he got on a streetcar. Then I went home, wondering whether I'd ever be as big a man as Joe Bailey. Passing the barn the next morning, his brothers heard a voice inside. Looking through the door, they saw their little brother standing on a feeding trough, practicing a political speech. From the day he heard Joe Bailey, Sam Rayburn knew what he was going to be. Knew precisely. He told his brothers and sisters and friends. As one recalls his words, I'm going to get myself elected to the state legislature. I'm going to spend about 3 terms there, and then I want to be elected speaker. After that, I'm going to run for Congress and be elected. He would be in the House of Representatives, he said, by the age of 30. And eventually, he said, he would be its speaker, too. Sam's ambition became a joke on the Rayburn farm. His brothers and sisters would stand outside the barn and laugh at the speeches being made inside. But the speeches went on. And in 1900, when he was 18 years old, Sam Rayburn, standing in a field with his father one day, told him he wanted to go to college. His father said he had no money to send him. "I'm not asking you to send me, Pa," Sam said. "I'm asking you to let me go." The cavalryman's back was stooped from the fields now. He was old. Two of his 8 sons had already left the farm. The loss of a 3rd pair of strong hands would be hard to bear. "You have my blessing," he said. On the day Sam left, his clothes rolled up and tied with a rope because he had no suitcase. His father hitched up the buggy and drove him to the railroad station. A silent man, he stood there silently until the train arrived and his son was about to board it. Then he suddenly reached out and pressed some bills into his son's hand. $25. Sam never forgot that. He talked about that $25 for the rest of his life. "God knows how he saved it," he would say. "He never had any extra money. We earned just enough to live. It broke me up, handing me that $25. I often wondered what he did without, what sacrifice he and my mother made." And he never forgot the 4 words his father said to him as he climbed aboard the train. He was to tell his friends that he remembered them at every crisis in his life. Clutching his son's hand, his father said, "Sam, be a man." Tuition at East Texas Normal College, a handful of buildings on a bleak prairie, was $12 a month. To supplement his parents' gift, he got a job sweeping out a nearby elementary school and became the college's bell ringer, running up to the bell tower every 45 minutes to signal the end of a class period. Unable even with those jobs to stay in school, he dropped out and taught for a year in a 1-room school to earn money, then returned to take a heavy load of courses and graduate with his class. He was so ashamed of his only suit and its frayed elbows that he tried to avoid attending the graduation ceremony. Then he got another teaching job, this one in Fannin County, held it for 2 years, and in 1906, at the age of 24, announced for the legislature. He campaigned on a little brown cow pony, riding from farm to farm. Unable to make small talk, he discussed farm problems. A short, solid young man with a hairline that was already receding, and earnest brown eyes. At each farm, he asked who lived on the next farm, so that when he got there, he could call them by name. 2 incidents in the campaign showed that he had not forgotten his father's 4 words of advice. A man approached him one day and said that a $10 contribution to an influential farmer would ensure the votes of the farmer's relatives. "I'm not trying to buy the office," Rayburn replied. "I'm asking the people to give it to me." He and his opponent, Sam Gardner of Honey Grove, became friends and, near the end of the campaign, rode from town to town together in a 1-horse buggy. Arriving in a town, they would take turns, standing in the back of the buggy and speaking. In one town, Gardner became ill and spent 3 days in bed. Although Gardner appeared to be leading, Rayburn didn't use the 3 days to campaign. He spent them with Gardner, nursing him. Gardner was to be a friend of Sam Rayburn's all his life. The votes were cast on a Saturday, but because the ballot boxes had to be brought into the county clerk's office in Bonham and the ballots counted by hand, the results would not be announced until Tuesday. Sam arranged for a friend with a fast horse to bring the news the 11 miles to the Rayburn farm. On Tuesday, he sat with his family in the living room, waiting for the hoofbeats that would announce his destiny. It was victory by 163 votes. In Austin, Sam Rayburn didn't forget where he came from. Enlisting in the small band, which included, of course, Sam Ely Johnson, then in his 2nd term in the legislature, which fought the interests and talked of the people, he introduced bills to regulate railroads and banks. Unlike some of that band, he never sold out. Years later, when someone mentioned that Rayburn's father had not left him much of an inheritance, Rayburn quickly corrected him. "His father," he said, "gave me my untarnished name." He kept it untarnished. He wouldn't drink at the Driscoll and wouldn't live there. Rooming at a cheap boarding house below the Capitol, he shared a small room to save his $5 per day salary for tuition at the University of Texas Law School. After paying his tuition, he was to recall, he had so little money that once, after offering to buy a soda for a representative named Farr, he realized that he had only a nickel to his name. "So when we got to the counter, I told Farr I wasn't feeling so well and would not take anything. He went on and got his drink, and I paid for it. I don't know what I'd have done if he had ordered a dime drink. But when, shortly after he had obtained his law degree and joined a law firm, one of his partners handed him the largest check he had ever seen as his share of a monthly retainer from the Santa Fe Railroad, he handed it back and added that he would never accept a dollar of the railroad's money. To his partner's request for an explanation, he replied, "I said to him that I was a member of the legislature, representing the people." Legislators were routinely presented with free railroad passes. Rayburn returned his, even though at the time he refused his pass, he was desperately lonely in Austin and unable to return home because he could not afford the fare. His mother approved. "We often wish for you to be with us," she wrote, "but we would rather wait a little longer than for you to accept free passes." It was while he was in Austin, where legislators were bought wholesale, that there was first heard a saying that men would be repeating for 50 years. "No one can buy Sam Rayburn." He didn't forget where he came from or where he was going. He discussed his ambitions with his fellow members of the Texas House of Representatives as bluntly as he had done years before with his brothers and sisters. He wanted to be Speaker of the House, he said, and he told them quite frankly why. "I've always wanted responsibility because I want the power responsibility brings." Not only did he know what he wanted, he knew, seemed to know instinctively, how to get it. Like Sam Johnson, he had an instinctive gift for the legislative process. But unlike Sam Johnson, he was not a romantic or a dreamer. When he helped someone, he insisted on help in return, even when the recipient of his aid was his idol. Arriving in Austin, Rayburn found his idol on trial there. Debate was raging over the threatened legislative investigation of Joseph Weldon Bailey, now a United States senator, accused of selling out to the railroads and to Standard Oil. Rayburn, who throughout his life was to refuse to believe those charges, offered his support to Bailey's legislative lieutenants, pointing out that, as the representative from Bailey's old district, his opinion might carry more weight than that of the average freshman legislator. But in return for his support, he said, he wanted more than might be given the average freshman legislator. He gave his support and proved, during his first days in the legislature, a very effective, if quiet, figure in Bailey's defense. And he got what he wanted in return. The backing of Bailey's lieutenants gave him, in his first term in the legislature, the chairmanship of a key legislative committee. A committee chairman's power was used to build more power. Legislators who received favors from him were expected to give favors in return. And the favors Rayburn asked for were, like the favors he gave, shrewdly chosen. Hardly had he arrived in the Texas House, it seemed, when he was a power in it, thanks to a gift, a rare gift, for legislative horse trading. He had other gifts, too, in particular, a very unusual force of personality. In part, that force was physical. Sam Rayburn was a short man, 5'6", but his body was broad and massive, the chest and shoulders so broad and thick that they bulged through the cheap fabric of his suits. His head, set on a bull neck, was massive too, and seemed even more massive than it was, for already in his 20s he was going almost completely bald, so that the loom of the great bare skull was unsoftened by hair. His wide, heavy face could be pleasant in private, but in public it was expressionless, immobile, grim. So hard were the thin line of the lips and the set of the wide jutting jaw that, except for the eyes that smoldered in it, it might have been the face of a stone statue, and it exuded an immense elemental strength. That aura was not dispelled by Sam Rayburn's character. Already men were whispering about his temper. When he lost it, and he lost it often, a deep flush would rise along the bull neck and completely cover the great head, and the lips so grim would twist in a snarl, and the voice so low would rasp. "In dark moods," one observer was to write, "his profanity was shattering." And as he cursed, he spat, and, as the observer tactfully put it, "if a cuspidor was handy, that was fine. If there wasn't, it was too bad." In a rage, Mr. Rayburn's face blackened in a terrible scowl, and his bald head turned deep red. That was the way he looked in a rage, and few cared to see such a mien turned upon themselves. When he lost control of that temper, he was deaf to reason. Not even considerations of career or ambition could stand before it. The most feared figure in Austin was the recently retired governor, Tom Campbell. The ruthlessness he had exhibited in the State House, rumor had it, had not been tempered since he had become lobbyist for the state's banking interests. And the power of those interests still enabled him to punish opponents. Rayburn, fighting bank-sponsored legislation in his committee and pushing his own, became an opponent. Campbell planted in cooperative newspapers stories that Rayburn was fighting in committee because he was afraid to fight in the open, articles that Rayburn considered an attack on his personal honor. Friends aware of his temper urged him not to lose it. Campbell, they warned him, had destroyed the careers of other men who had opposed him, even indirectly. Rayburn thereupon took the floor of the House with a speech that was not indirect. His own bills, he said, are in the interest of the people, and I will stand here day by day and vote for them. It matters not to me what Mr. Campbell's views are. Pausing, he raised his great head and stared straight at Campbell, who was sitting in the gallery, not speaking again until everyone in the chamber was staring at Campbell, too. Then he said, "It matters not to me whether Tom Campbell stands for a measure or against it. Tom Campbell, in my opinion, is the least thing to be considered in legislation." The temper, the aura of immense strength, the legislative cunning, the implacable standards. In Austin, men learned that they couldn't buy Sam Rayburn, and that they couldn't cross him. Nor was his temper the only striking aspect of Sam Rayburn's character. His colleagues talked not only of his rage, but of his rigidity. His standards were very simple, and not subject to compromise. He talked a lot about honor and loyalty, and he meant what he said. "There are no degrees in honorableness," he would say. "You are or you aren't." Harsh though that rule was, he lived up to it. Says one of his fellow legislators, "He had a reputation for honesty and fair dealing. You could always swear by anything Sam told you." And he insisted that others live up to it, too. "Once you lied to Rayburn, why, you'd worn out your credentials," an aide says. "You didn't get a second chance." His colleagues learned, however, that if they paid Sam Rayburn what they owed him, they would never be shortchanged. His friendship, they learned, was a gift to be cherished. "If he was your friend, he was your friend forever," one man was to say. "He would be with you, always. The tougher the going, the more certain you could be that when you looked around, Sam Rayburn would be standing there with you. I never met a man so loyal to a friend." He used the words just and fair a lot, and his colleagues learned that he meant those words too. Whether or not he liked an issue was actually immaterial, a friend said. He kept saying he wanted to find out what was right. And after a while you realized, by God, he was trying to do just that. He would spend about 3 terms in the legislature, he had told his brothers and sisters so many years before, and then he would be elected speaker. During his 3rd term, he ran for speaker. His speech in the well of the House was to the point. "If you have anything for me," he told his colleagues, "give it to me now." It was a personal appeal, and the response was personal. Bailey's weight was behind him, but that was not a decisive factor, not for a candidate supported by none of the state's major power interests. "Sam Rayburn was elected," says one of his colleagues, "because of the simple respect everyone had for him." For a moment, the iron facade cracked, and the emotion beneath it showed, but only for a moment. When the vote was announced, recalls a friend, "Sam jumped up and gave a cotton patch yell and then sat down real quick, like he was ashamed of himself." There was another brief crack during his acceptance speech. "Up in Fannin County there's an old man already past his 60, and by his side there sits an old woman, at whose feet I would delight to worship," he said. "For them also I thank you." A speaker's power was used to get more. That power, the speaker's rights and duties, had been undefined. When, at his direction, they were defined now by a committee of his friends, the definition gave the speaker unprecedented power. He had no reluctance to use it. He himself recalled that, "I saw that all my friends got the good appointments, and that those who voted against me for speaker got none." Even supporters could not threaten him, When he turned down their nominee for a clerkship, their spokesman told him, "If you don't appoint her, I'll get up a petition signed by a majority." "I don't give a damn if every member signs your petition," Rayburn replied. "I still won't appoint her." And he knew what he wanted to use his power for. During his single year as Speaker, the Texas House of Representatives passed significant legislation regulating utilities, railroads, and banks, including bills whose passage the populists had been urging without hope for years. A single year. He had, after all, told his brothers and sisters that he would be in Congress by the age of 30, and now, in 1912, he was 30. He appointed a committee to redraw the boundaries of congressional districts, and the committee removed from the Fannin County District the home county of the state senator who would have been his most formidable opponent. Running for Congress, he evoked his destiny. "When I was a schoolboy," he said, "I made up my mind that I was going to run for Congress when I was 30. I have reached that age, and I am running for Congress. I believe I have lived to be worthy of your support. I believe I will be elected." He displayed a quiet but effective wit. "I will not deny that there are men in the district better qualified than I to go to Congress, but, gentlemen, these men are not in the race." And he was elected. Decades later, when Sam Rayburn was a legend, one aspect of the legend, fostered by the brief, almost cryptic terseness of his rare speeches, was taciturnity, at least in public. And the reporters who created the legend, who had not known Sam Rayburn when he was a young congressman, assumed that such taciturnity had always been a Rayburn characteristic. It hadn't. He had been in Congress less than a month, in fact, when he took the floor. He was aware, he said, of the long-established custom of this House, which demands that discussions shall be left to the more mature members. But he was going to break that custom, to refuse to be relegated to that lock-jawed ostracism. He was refusing, he said, because he represented 200,000 people, and they needed someone to speak for them. And in his speech, which lasted for almost 2 hours, he did indeed speak for them, pouring out all the bitterness and resentment that had, a generation before, made the northeast corner of Texas a stronghold of the Texas Alliance and of the People's Party. The issue was the tariff. The House, newly Democratic, was, under the spur of the newly inaugurated Woodrow Wilson, debating the Underwood Bill, which would begin to reform the tariff laws that populists hated by, for example, placing shoes as well as steer hides on the free list. "The Republicans talk about the hard deal the producer is getting in this bill," Rayburn said. "The Republican Party," he said, "is always willing and anxious to take that small, rich class under its protective wing, but unwilling at all times to heed the great chorus of sad cries ever coming from the large yet poor class, the American consumer." "What's wrong," he demanded, "with reducing the price of the shoes a man must buy to protect the feet of his children? The system that kept that price high was the most indefensible system the world has ever known. Under it, the poor man is compelled to pay more than the rich man, and manufacturers fatten their already swollen purses with more ill-gotten gains wrung from the horny hands of the toiling masses, from the people who have forever been ground under the heel of taxation with a relentless tread." He was especially bitter about the Republicans' attempt, then in full stride, to persuade the farmer that tariffs were really in his best interest. "The Republicans talk about the farmer," he said. "What did they know about the farmer? What consideration have they shown him?" "They would find that they underestimated the farmer," he said. "They would learn to their shock that they are dealing with a thinking and intelligent class." The Democratic Party, the party of the masses, was in power at last. Its representatives were men who came from every walk of life and who were fresh from the people, who knew their hopes and their aspirations and their wants and their sufferings. Its president was clean and matchless, with the great heart and mind that he could interpret the inarticulate longings of suffering humanity. The Democrats would pass the Underwood Bill, reduce the tariffs, break up these swollen fortunes, destroy the trusts, lift the load from the bending backs, the stooped and weary backs, of the farmers and laboring class. Decades later, when Sam Rayburn was a legend and reporters constantly quoted his advice to young congressmen, to get along, go along. One aspect of the legend was the assumption that when he was a young congressman, he had gone along, that he had subordinated his own views to those of his party and its leaders. He hadn't. As a young congressman, he had gone along with no one, not even with the president of his own party, whom he idolized. During his second year in the House, he wrote, himself, with no staff assistance, a bill embodying the old People's Party dream of intensified government regulation of railroads, by giving the government authority over the issuance of new securities by the railroads. Happening by chance to see the bill, Louis D. Brandeis, then one of President Wilson's advisers, thought it so good that, says Wilson biographer Arthur Link, it was made one of the three measures that formed the centerpiece of the president's campaign against the trusts. Despite the opposition of the senior member of the Texas delegation, the popular and powerful John Nance Garner, Rayburn pushed the bill to passage in the House. In a note hand-delivered to Rayburn, the president said he had watched Rayburn's fight with admiration and genuine appreciation, and for some months thereafter invited him frequently to the White House. But the heady moment passed. Railroad lobbyists killed the bill in the Senate, and by the following year Wilson had had second thoughts. Rayburn was told that the president did not want the bill reintroduced. Although he knew that without White House support the cause was lost, as indeed it proved to be, Rayburn refused to stop fighting for it. He introduced the bill anyway. This was an embarrassment to the White House. Rayburn was told the president did not want the bill actively pushed. Rayburn actively pushed it. The president sent the message again, via a messenger whose orders he was sure would be obeyed, the leader of Rayburn's own state delegation, Cactus Jack Garner himself. Rayburn continued pushing. Then Wilson summoned the obstinate freshman to the White House to give him the order face to face. If Wilson received an answer at all, it was a short one. Rayburn was to recall, replying in a single sentence, "I'm sorry I can't go along with you, Mr. President." Turning his back on his clean and matchless idol, he walked out of the room without another word. Angered by his recalcitrance, President Wilson threw the weight of the White House behind Rayburn's opponent in the next Democratic primary. Holding his seat nonetheless, Rayburn, on his return to Congress, introduced half a dozen railroad bills against the president's wishes, secured the passage of several, and was eventually to play a crucial role in winning the 8-hour day for railroad workers. Admiring colleagues gave him a nickname, the Railroad Legislator. And he was active, defiantly and eloquently active, often against the wishes of party leaders, in other areas, including the creation of the Federal Trade Commission. One aspect of the legend that was true was his personal integrity. Men learned in Washington what they had learned in Austin. No one could cross Sam Rayburn, and no one could buy him. Lobbyists could not buy him so much as a meal. Not even the taxpayer could buy him a meal. Spurning the conventional congressional junket, Rayburn would, during his 48 years in Congress, take exactly one overseas trip, a trip to inspect the Panama Canal that he considered necessary because his committee was considering canal legislation. And on that trip, he insisted on paying his own way. He refused not only fees, but travel expenses for out-of-town speeches. Hosts who, thinking his refusal pro forma, attempted to press checks upon him, quickly realized that they had made a mistake. The face, already so hard, would become harder. Rayburn would say, "I'm not for sale," and then he would walk away without a backward glance, as he had walked away from a president. His integrity was certified by his bank book. At his death, at the age of 79, after decades as one of the most powerful men in the United States, a man courted by railroad companies and oil companies, his savings totaled $15,000. Sam Rayburn's blocky figure, pounding along the Capitol corridors with strides that one observer likened to the pumping of a piston, seemed broader now, even more massive, the face beneath the bald skull even more grim and hard. The impression of physical strength was not misleading. Once, two big congressmen, one was a 230-pound six-footer, Thomas Blanton of Texas, the name of the other has been lost in time, got into a fist fight. Stepping between them, Rayburn pushed them apart. Then, bunching each man's lapels in one hand, he held them apart, his arms rigid. Standing between two men almost a head taller who were thrashing furiously in his grip, he held them, each with one hand, until they had quieted down, as effortlessly as if they had been two crying babies. But it was not his physical strength that most impressed his colleagues. About his integrity, one said, "Amidst the multitude, he was the incorruptible." About his accomplishments when he was still new on the hill, another said, introducing him on the floor for a speech in 1916 during his second term in Congress, "He is a member young in years but old in accomplishment." In a body in which seniority or powerful friends ordinarily determined a member's standing, Sam Rayburn, who possessed neither, was already, solely because of the strength of his personality, a formidable figure. He was going to need this strength. As a boy, he had vowed that he would become Speaker of the House of Representatives. Now, as he stood each day amidst the milling and confusion of the House floor, there loomed above him, so aloof and alone on the topmost tier of the triple-tiered white-marbled dais, the single high-backed Speaker's chair. From the day he arrived in Congress, he wanted to be in that chair, wanted the Speaker's gavel in his hand. He knew how he would wield it, just as he knew for whom. For the people, against the interests. For years, no speaker had dominated the House, and the result was confusion and ineffectiveness. It was during his early years in the House that Sam Rayburn, in a private conversation, suddenly burst out, "Some day a man will be elected who'll bring the speakership into respectability again. He'll be the real leader of the House. He'll be master around here, and everyone will know it." He knew himself to be capable of such mastery. Had he not, after all, demonstrated it already in another speaker's chair? He felt, moreover, that the high-backed chair and the gavel were his destiny. Had not every other element of his boyhood prediction, election to the Texas House, to its speakership, to the National Congress, already been fulfilled? His first years in the House may have given him the illusion that the fulfillment of that destiny was not far off. During those years he had dealt with the President and with presidential advisers, had seen his name in the Eastern press, had become somewhat of a figure in the House. Now reality set in, the long reality. In 1918, the Democrats lost control of the House of Representatives. They were not to regain it for 12 years. For 12 years, Sam Rayburn would be in the minority. A minority congressman of insignificant seniority had power to realize neither his dreams for others nor his dream for himself. There was no way of circumventing, no way of battering down this fact. John Garner had said, "The only way to get anywhere in Congress is to stay there and let seniority take its course." Rayburn had not wanted to believe that. Now he learned that he had no choice. As the prosperity of the '20s waxed brighter, so did the fortunes of the grand old party, the party identified with the glow. Harding was succeeded by Coolidge, and Coolidge by Hoover, and Republican majorities in Congress grew and grew and grew again, and Democratic congressmen were allowed little voice in its affairs. Sam Rayburn, who had rushed toward his destiny, was going to have to wait. The waiting was made harder by the lack of assurance that it would ever be rewarded. This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette.